Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. 400 years ago this month, the first kidnapped Africans arrived on the shores of Virginia, then a British colony. This was the beginning of slavery in this country, and my guest, Sherry Burr, uncovered some remarkable facts about this time in her new book, Complicated Lives, Free Blacks in Virginia, 1619 to 1865. Burr is the Dickison Chair in Law and Regents Professor Emerita at the University of New Mexico School of Law, and she's the author of 27 books, including this one. Professor Burr has curated a related exhibition that's at the African American Performing Arts Center in Albuquerque through October 26th. Sherry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Megan, for having me. I'm so excited to be here because this has been a passion project for me for about 6 years since I first discovered that my family descended from African Americans who were free before the Civil War.
You anticipated my question. How did you get so interested in researching those?
A bag of letters, actually, in my garage. I was sorting through material, and I found one from a great aunt saying that she was on her way to Wyoming to look up on her aunt, Aunt Lillian. And I started to wonder, what was a black woman doing living in Wyoming? Which, of course, is a strange question from a black woman living in New Mexico. So I had a research trip up north, and I decided I'll just stop in and see. And I found her address. I knocked on the door, and I introduced myself as the great-great niece of Lillian Faye Todd. And the woman said, come on in. And it turned out her name was Mrs. Lucy Vigil, and she was from Wagon Mound, New Mexico. And then I ended up installing a headstone at Aunt Lillian's grave because it didn't have a headstone. And as a consequence of that, I met many of her friends who were still alive. And she had been gone 38 years by the time I did this. And I started to wonder, what kind of woman is so amazing that she generates all this love and she's been gone 38 years? So I just happened to be on a flight to Salt Lake City to give a talk. And my seatmate said, oh, you should check out the Family History Library. So I thought, I'll be there for 15 minutes. Well, 3 hours later, I'm walking out in the rain with the stack of census records, and there's a schedule that says free inhabitants of Virginia, 1850, and it includes Aunt Lillian's father, who was my great-great-grandfather, John W. Hill. He was 3 years old at the time, and he was living on the farm of his grandfather. So then I started to wonder, oh my God, I had no idea that African Americans were living free in the South before the Civil War. So that started this research project.
What are some of the assumptions we may have about race and slavery that this book reframes or even debunks?
Well, and there are assumptions that I had, which are that all blacks living in the South were slaves before the Civil War, all white people owned slaves before the Civil War, and neither of those were true. In fact, a hefty percentage of African Americans were living free in the South since 1619, and also only 25% of whites owned slaves in the South. The other assumption is that there was not slavery in the North, and that's not true. In Philadelphia, around 1760s, 1770s, on the eve of the Revolutionary War, about 25% of households owned slaves. So it's been interesting to me to just see how different the reality is from our perceptions. And I put a chart in the book that show and in the exhibition that shows at no point during the entire antebellum period were there more free blacks living in the North than there were in the South. There were always more free blacks living in the South than the North.
You demonstrate the first kidnapped Africans brought here were not considered slaves by the English colonists. They were more like indentured servants, which meant you're eventually supposed to be freed.
Exactly. Right? And one of the things that people have to keep in mind is that the House of Burgess, the first legislative body, had just formed in July 1619, and the first Africans arrived in August 1619. So there's no way for them to really think, oh my God, we got these black people, they have to be slaves. Probably many, some, we don't know exactly exactly how it all worked out, but we do know that several were treated as indentured servants because they received freedom, they received land, and one of the most prominent, Anthony Johnson, who married Mary, who came over from Angola the year after he did, they owned a plantation of sizable amount, and they imported English servants to work on their plantation.
That was so interesting. And then there was a very important legal case regarding them. They had a man who was, they considered a servant for life, essentially
right.
a slave.
Right.
He was saying, no, I was an indentured servant. I'm not supposed to be a slave. So you have a free black family arguing this black man should be their slave for life. And on the other side, he and I think the white planter saying, no, he's an indentured servant. I just blew my mind.
I know. And I start out with that because it is mind-boggling. And it shows that the world that they lived in was much more complicated than we have been led to believe it was. And the reason why Anthony Johnson said that John Kaser was a servant for life was because he didn't have indentured papers. So it was the indentured papers that stated how much time you would work and at what point would you be free. So the white planters come in on behalf of John Kaser to say, no, he's an indentured servant. He's already served his time. And if Anthony Johnson doesn't release him, John Kaser should get all of Anthony Johnson's cows. Well, he's running a farm. So he talks with his wife and his sons, and they decide we can't afford to let go of our cows. We have to let go of John Kaser.
Although eventually that's reversed, right?
Yes, it's reversed and then reversed again. So it's reversed. But we know that John Kaser ends up living in Maryland on a farm of his own. So we know it was reversed again. So he does end up being a free man.
Talk a little bit about how we get from something like that to a place where slavery is much more prevalent.
So there were several things going on in the colony at the time, one of which is the lack of English women. So the first significant group of English women came over in November 1619. So they came over several months after the first significant group of Africans. And the Africans were always pretty much evenly balanced. The other thing that's going on at that time is that pretty much all males have the right to vote once they start this House of Burgess. And it's not till 1670 that they change it to say that only landowners will have the right to vote. But that still includes people like Anthony Johnson. But it eliminates people who are indentured because they're not yet to the point where they can own land. And it's in 1670 that they finally pass a law, and it's the most convoluted thing, right? It starts with, this issue has come up as to whether Indians are slaves, and we've concluded that all servants arriving by ships will be considered servants for life if they are not Christians, but those arriving by land will become indentured servants. How convoluted is that, right?
It is.
Because we know it's Africans who are coming over by ship and it's Indians who are coming over by land, right? And then they say, even if you come over by ship, but if you can prove you're a Christian, you'll still be an indentured servant. That is what we call compromise lawmaking. And I think it's because there were people within the legislature who could never bring themselves to say all Africans absolutely from here on out are slaves.
How did these forces begin to work to create more enslaved African Americans and fewer free blacks?
It was a combination of factors. One, there's this other law that was passed in 1668 that said that free women give birth to free children and enslaved women give birth to enslaved children. So that was a reversal of heritage from English rules, because for millennia, English rules are all patrilineal. The first son inherits the estate and his first son inherits the estate and so forth. So this was the first time that a group of people of English descent had had reversed patrilineal heritage. So they're now saying if someone is already enslaved and that person gives birth to children, those children will be enslaved. So that sets up this kind of perpetual enslavement from which you do not escape. And what it meant was that if someone has enslaved women on his plantation, he can father children with them, and those children become property. They become slaves, not free men. So if it had not been reversed, a white male fathering children with an enslaved woman, then those children would be free because he was free.
If you're just tuning in, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking with Professor Sherry Burr of the UNM School of Law about her new book, Complicated Lives, Free Blacks in Virginia, 1619 to 1865. During this time period, the population of free blacks does continue to grow
yes.
in Virginia.
Yes. It's growing because the free black women are continuing to give birth to free children. Mm. So that's why it's growing. It's also growing because there are free white plantation owners who are troubled by the concept of slavery. And this reaches ahead during the Revolutionary War because a lot of white men are saying, how can we fight for our freedom from Great Britain and keep others enslaved? So after the Revolutionary War, there was a fervent of people being released from slavery. And that's how my fourth great grandfather got released from slavery. So he was a 2-year-old when his owner, Benjamin Crawley, released 50 people from slavery in a document of emancipation.
These growth in these numbers of free blacks apparently started to terrify Virginia's governing officials.
Yes.
What did they do? I mean, they did a number of things. One thing is they passed laws saying you could not free your slaves.
Right.
For
so,
a time.
Yeah. So occasionally what would happen is the population would grow. This would make certain people uncomfortable. So they would pass laws saying you can't free your slaves unless we, the government, frees them for meritorious service. And then at another point, they said you can free your slaves, but they have to leave Virginia within a year of and a day of receiving freedom.
Because they might foment discontent?
Yes, because just the idea of seeing slaves seeing other free black people would think, well, why am I a slave? One of the things I wanted to bring out is slavery is a legal construct. Over time, it's not something that's inherent based on the person's color. And I even mentioned in the book that there were white people like Captain John Smith who had been enslaved in Turkey. He had been captured in a war before he came to Virginia, and he was enslaved. And the way he released himself was he, what I call, self-liberated. He killed the owner, donned his clothes, and rode off on his horse, got back to England, and ended up on one of those ships coming to Virginia in 1607. So that was going on worldwide. If you lost or you were part of a group that lost a war, you could be enslaved. It didn't matter the color of your skin. This was happening to Europeans. It was happening in Asia. It was happening in the Arab world. And it was definitely happening in the African world.
What was the significance of differentiating, you talk about this in the book, between chattel and real estate? And what impact did that have on people who were enslaved?
Yeah, isn't that? It was really wild because they were trying to figure out taxation. How do we tax slaves? So they were taxing all men, had to pay a tax on their personhood, and all black women had to pay a tax on their person. So they had to pay a tax just to be in Virginia. So then they were trying to decide, well, how do we tax slaves? Because they're owned by other people. So they go back and forth. At one point, they say, okay, we're going to treat slaves as realty. It's sort of similar to the laws in England where everything passed with the land. So if the father died, then the oldest son would inherit not only the land, but also the realty, everything connected to the land. So if you treat slaves as realty, then everything connected to the land would go be inherited by the next successor. So then they decided, well, this is really kind of hard, because what happens when someone dies and they've got five children? If that person would naturally leave all the land to one child, then the slaves have to go with that one child. So they eventually switch it to call slaves chattel, like personal property. So that allowed someone who was dying to will the slaves to different children. And I examined a lot of wills where they would do weird things. And this is in particular a reference that I looked at it for a woman named Hannah. I was trying to figure out how my fourth great grandfather, whose mother was named Hannah, how she ended up in the Crawley family. So I spent several hours in the Library of Virginia going through all these books, looking at every Hannah that was ever mentioned as a slave. And they would do things like, okay, we're going to will Hannah to the first son, but her increase will be shared by son two and daughter one. And that would so shock me, because by increase, they were talking about her children. So they were talking about the separation of children at birth among the family members. And this happened so often that by the time I finished this research, there were tears pouring down my eyes, because I just couldn't imagine. Poor Hannah, all these Hannahs were losing their children because of this separation that was set in someone's will.
You also write about the Louisiana Purchase being disastrous.
Exactly, because when Thomas Jefferson arranged for the purchase of Louisiana territory, it was considered a bargain because he got it for the land for a good deal. But what happened was, around the same time, he had also gotten the legislature, Congress, to pass a law saying there will be no more importation of slaves. So he was considering that a good deal, because we're cutting off the African slave trade. No more slaves can come in. And Virginia itself had done this right after the Revolutionary War, saying that we're not allowing any more Africans to be shipped into Virginia. And if someone does that, the person will be free within a year. So it was trying to discourage the intercontinental slave trade. But the reason why it turned out to be a disaster is because that set off this land grab where a lot of whites moved west. There were all those Indian wars where Indians were dispossessed of their land. And then once the Indians were removed, there became this demand for slaves in order to farm the land. The combination of the cutoff of the intercontinental slave trade meant that the value of the people who were already enslaved increased, and particularly the value of African women, because they could produce more slaves. Mm-hmm. So they were more considered more valuable than a man, because this one, especially one of childbearing age, then, you know, she might produce eight children. That's eight more slaves. Yeah. It was horrible, because Virginia ended up selling all these slaves to Louisiana and that territory. And so a lot of families got split up. And of course, it was harder to get back if you're sold that far south. And the most well-known story is what happened to Solomon Northup, because he was kidnapped out of Washington, D.C. He's from New York, went to D.C. voluntarily, got kidnapped, sold
south. As a free man,
free black man, sold south. And he was enslaved for 12 years. It took a while for him to become liberated from his condition.
That was the 12 Years a Slave.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Book and movie. Yeah, even if someone gained their freedom or was born free, like he was, they could be kidnapped and sold into slavery. Were there not laws against this?
There were laws. And Virginia passed laws. In fact, the most onerous law they passed that said if someone kidnaps a free black, they're subject to the death penalty. And my fourth great grandmother was actually kidnapped. She and her mother were kidnapped out of Maryland and brought to Virginia. And their kidnapper was trying to sell them, but they protested and they ended up living with William Prentice, who I think was the mayor of Petersburg. And he told their kidnapper, you need to come back with papers. Because that was the other thing. If a slave was property, you had to show that you had the legal right with a piece of paper to control this person. And so he never came back with paperwork because he didn't have any. And so eventually when William Prentice wrote this letter stating how my fourth great grandmother and her mother were indeed free.
People would actually will their enslaved spouse, assuming of a free person married to a slave, they would will their enslaved spouses to their children.
Yes, this happened with Sarah Spears. As she was dying, she was trying to figure out what to do with her husband, Bob. Virginia at that time, this was the 1830s, had passed the rule that if you free someone, they have to leave Virginia within a year and a day. And the surrounding states of Virginia, including Ohio, had passed laws that saying people being freed out of slavery in Virginia were not welcome in their territories. So that led her to think, what do I do about Bob? I don't want him to be freed because then he has to leave and he might be subjected to a kidnapper who would sell him further south. So she ended up willing him to her children. And she could do that because she's a free woman, so all her children are born free. So, yeah, that's a strange family dynamic that the children inherit their father as a slave.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. My guest today is Professor Sherry Burr from the UNM School of Law. She's the author of the new book, Complicated Lives, Free Blacks in Virginia, 1619 to 1865. And she has curated a related exhibition. It's at the African American Performing Arts Center in Albuquerque through October 26th. By 1860, there were many free blacks owning significant land in Virginia, including, as you say, some of your ancestors. I'm trying to imagine this. How do you create a place in a society like that where there's also rampant slavery? It's so odd.
Yes, it is. It is odd. One of the things I tell people is that this society before the Civil War is totally integrated. So it's not like blacks and whites are living in separate communities. They're living side by side. So what we think of as the segregation that that we associate with the South, that happened after the Civil War, after the Reconstruction. So before that, African Americans and whites are living side by side. Yes, there are slaves, you know, maybe living next door. And even in 12 Years a Slave, he talks about how one of the slaves, Patsy, would go visit a free black woman in Mississippi living next door to the plantation. And so that's another example of how convoluted the social relations were, because all blacks weren't slaves. Some of them were free, and free blacks and slaves would sometimes interact. And they particularly interacted at churches.
Many of our early leaders were slaveholders, but they also wrote about the evils of slavery.
Right.
How is this possible?
Right. I mean, and to me, that's why I have this chapter on the national leaders and the anti-slavery slaveholding paradox, because none of them are coming out and saying slavery is absolutely right. They know it's wrong, and yet it benefits them. It allows them to lead a comfortable life, so they say it's wrong as a moral cause, that it's absolutely wrong, but they are not actively engaged in eliminating it and changing the way society works.
You also write that the lives of free blacks remind us that the Civil War could have been avoided.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So over 600,000 people died because of the Civil War, and over a million were maimed. And yet, after the Revolutionary War, it should have ended. It should have never gotten started. And it didn't have to get started, which is why I show the progression of the laws. They could have just continued with the indentured servant route, and which would free everybody after a certain period of time. And then once it got started, it could have very much ended after the Civil War. And that's when it should have ended.
Do you feel
not the Civil War. It should have ended after the Revolutionary War.
Do you feel it evolved that way purely from capitalistic money considerations, or were there other more convoluted things about racial purity? What was the basis of sort of evolving that way?
You know, it's interesting that you asked that question, because I have come to the conclusion that the racial purity elements were justifications for the economic outcomes. Like, basically, slavery is motivated by greed, but we have to justify this. And one of the ways we justify this is we start saying that Africans deserve this. They are not human beings of the same quality as whites.
It's horribly ironic that then these sort of racial purity notions really take hold after Reconstruction, and actually, in a lot of ways, free blacks faced more restrictions after Reconstruction failed, or was forced to fail, I should say,
yes,
and Jim Crow was enacted, than they had before the war.
I know. Isn't that irony? Yeah. It's ironic. I mean, it's mind-boggling how things change and how the racial hatred that we associate with the South developed after the war. And these monuments to Robert E. Lee developed, you know, they weren't installed until like the 30s, 40s, 50s. You know, Robert E. Lee was a failed general. Southern whites weren't running around saying, "All hail Robert E. Lee." He lost the war. He lost their cause. It wasn't till later that he was used as the symbol of white supremacy. But that's not what it was about at the beginning.
And unfortunately, apparently, the Nazis got a lot of ideas from us.
Yes. I was giving a talk in Florida, and I said, you know, it's really interesting because I've done this research about Nazis over the decades, and then I started doing this research about African Americans who were freed before the Civil War. And I was shocked that Nazis were defining who's a Jew, similar to the way the South was defining who's a Negro.
It went from like sort of half to a
quarter
to an eighth to one drop.
Right, exactly. And it turned out that the Nazis actually based their laws on the South, on the apartheid South is what they called it. So to me, that's another reason why this history has to get out, because we see how it can just replicate itself.
Sherry, what do you want us to take away from the experiences of free blacks as we make policies now and in the future, as we think about who we are as a nation?
Well, I want us to understand how complicated our early history was, and that certain turns in legislation led to these so many difficult outcomes for not only for whites, but also for blacks. I mean, the Civil War, for example. And that the more we understand that, I'm hoping that we will correct our actions and stop doing this. And one thing I mentioned in the epilogue to the book is my concern about the separation of children at the border, because so many African women lost their children. They were taken from them during slavery. And it pains me to see something that happened 200 years ago being replicated again. So I hope that the more people learn this history, the more we can stand up and say, no, we need to stop this, because we know the road that that leads to.
That was Sherry Burr. She's the Dickison Chair in Law and Regents Professor Emerita at the University of New Mexico School of Law. Her latest book is Complicated Lives, Free Blacks in Virginia, 1619 to 1865. And Professor Burr has curated a related exhibition that's at the African American Performing Arts Center in Albuquerque through October 26th. You can find this and all our previous episodes of University Showcase at KUNM.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.